Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
This conclave is probably going to be open to a pope from just about anywhere. It's no longer now the hegemony of Europe.
The rich people in our country have decided that we're going to have gay marriage. And I mean the rich people of both parties.
Your pastor, with all of his failings and shortcomings and his jerky behavior, is a mask of the faithful good shepherd who is not a jerk.
When he comes in and he takes the strong man's stuff, he doesn't keep it for himself. That's what we were going to be expecting. Well, that's what we would do. If I overcome you, I take what's yours and it's mine. But he gives it away.
Thank you for providing theology for clerical collar, white collar, and blue collar.
Well, they're not just in textbooks or science books. They're kind of everywhere around us. It's become part of pop culture. It's become part of pop science to consider these icons of evolution, these pictures, these depictions, these famous experiments that are supposed to, hands down, prove that evolution is the right model for understanding human origins and really the origins of everything. Well, how do we respond to them? Do they hold water? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Joel Heck will join us here in the first half hour. We'll be doing part three of our seven-part series on creation today, those icons of evolution. A little bit later, Pastor Dan Pazika joins us. We'll talk about African-American Lutheranism. You can join us, 1-877-623-6943. Talkback at issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, at issuesetc. And our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Joel Heck is a regular guest, professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, author of the book In the Beginning, God, and he'll be one of the speakers at a conference July the 8th through the 10th at Concordia University, Wisconsin, titled The Heavens Declare What Astronomy Can Tell Us About Biblical Creation. Dr. Heck, welcome back.
Thank you for the welcome. It's good to be with you once again.
I don't know if they still put it in the kids' textbooks anymore, but it was there when I was growing up. I'm sure you as well. That depiction of ape to man, where there's kind of the primitive ape walking on his knuckles, then there's someone slightly more upright, and then someone slightly more upright. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got you and me walking along with maybe a laptop in our hands. That's one of the biggest icons of evolution. What is it attempting to depict, and is there any evidence for it?
Well, it's described by Jonathan Wells as the ultimate icon because it has to do with human evolution, which is what was one of Darwin's objects. He says, and I quote, "My object is to show that there is no fundamental difference between man and the higher animals in their mental faculties." And we all know how powerful an image can be, a picture can be. A picture is worth a thousand words, and sometimes a whole lot more than that. So by putting some pictures together to enable people to conceive of what they're trying to drive at, then they can be a little bit more convincing as a result. The unfortunate thing for the evolutionary perspective is that there have been a lot of frauds that have been perpetrated in the name of evolution, of creatures that were supposedly halfway houses between apes and human beings and have been later on exposed, and those frauds are only grudgingly admitted. And the reality is that fossils, and as well as human remains, bones and the like, don't come with dates stamped on them or tags to indicate when they existed and what their ancestors were or what their successors would look like. So those are simply guesses, and most of them are rather poor guesses at the same time.
So it sounds like that depiction that has this kind of unbroken stages from ape to man can't be even verified by the fossil record.
No, I don't think so. In fact, there's some powerful quotations. There's Sally Zuckerman is a scientific materialist and evolutionist who complains about the speculation on human origins. She says it is so astonishing that it is legitimate to ask whether much science is yet to be found in this field at all. Talking about the science of human origins and the allegations of the evolving of an ape or an ape-like creature into a human being. And she's not speaking as a Christian or as a creationist. She's talking about evolution from an evolutionary perspective and someone who holds to that position herself.
Another image that often appears in the textbooks, and it's a very powerful one, speaking kind of literally of these icons, is what's often called Darwin's Tree of Life. What does it look like, and what is it saying?
Yes, Darwin's Tree of Life is one of the favorite ones. He puts that diagram in the Origin of Species. It's supposed to show the fossil record, reflect the fossil record, and show how all of the species that exist today came from a few original creatures, and to show the various levels of evolution from more primitive and smaller types of creatures to more well-developed and larger and more complex creatures down the road. The problem is that the early fossil record turns that tree of life upside down. And the reality is that the highest levels of life, advanced forms of life, appear right at the start. And this is what scientists call the Cambrian explosion that supposedly happened 600 million years ago. The fossil record shows all kinds of forms of life and advanced forms of life at that, showing up right at the start with no evidence of this long, gradual process of evolution from primitive and single-celled or multi-celled creatures into the more complex creatures that show up in the Earth today.
And haven't these two first icons that we've talked about, haven't they kind of in many ways had to undergo major revision, especially the Tree of Life, that used to depict man with apes back closer to the trunk of the tree and man out at the end of the branches? Haven't they modified that significantly now to kind of say, okay, we really can't account for chimpanzees this way, so we got to put them in another branch?
There have been attempts to solve the problem of this Cambrian explosion. One prominent evolutionist, I think it's Stephen Jay Gould, but I'm not sure, don't hold me to that, came up with the idea of punctuated equilibrium, that there are long stages in the history of the Earth. If you assume billions of years for the age of the Earth, there are long phases of time where there was no change, and then all of a sudden there were tremendous amount of changes that happened very, very rapidly. They're trying to explain the lack of evidence in the fossil record and say, well, the changes just weren't recorded. We just didn't get to see them because they happened so quickly, which is exactly the opposite of what the typical argument is. We can't see the changes because they happen so slowly. So the question is, which is it? Are the changes too fast or are they too slow for us to be able to see them? And Darwin himself admitted, and this is, again, an Origin of Species, but I also have read Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial. That was a book, I believe, from 1991 that started the intelligent design movement. Darwin admitted that there would have to be huge numbers of intermediate species in the direct line between more primitive species and the more modern and complex species in order for his theory to be true, but in fact the fossil record didn't show it in Darwin's day, and it still doesn't show those numbers of intermediate species today. So there have been changes, yes. Most definitely.
Speaking of, Darwin himself, are Darwin's finches also an icon of evolution?
Yes, Darwin's finches, considered by some to be some of the best evidence for evolution that there is. Darwin went on his famous several-year voyage to the Galapagos Islands, and the Galapagos Islands have 13 different species of finches, and Darwin is supposed to have formulated his theory of evolution based on what he discovered with the finches. Problem is that the finches did not impress Darwin as evidence for evolution. In fact, they aren't discussed in Darwin's diary of the Beagle Voyage except for one passing reference. He did not correlate the diet of birds with beak shape, which he did later on. And some of his geographical information was wrong, and it's only years later that he looked back at the finches and reinterpreted them in the light of his theory. But his theory was that the change in the size of the beaks of these different finches is a small change and showing the bird evolving, and that if you extrapolate that to other features of the bird, then you can see the entire bird evolving. But the problem is that the size of the beaks, which tended to be a little bit larger during drought, the theory was that during drought, only those birds that had larger and more powerful beaks would be able to crack the hard shells of some of the seeds that they wanted to eat, and that would allow them to get to the seed and eat the seed, and they would survive. And so the finches tended to have larger bodies and beaks after a drought. Well, the unfortunate thing for that theory is that this was actually examined by some scientists, and they discovered that after the 1982-1983 El Nino that brought plentiful food, the average beak size, which had been growing to be larger prior to the El Nino, the average beak size returned to its previous size, and so there is no advance over the course of those decades after all.
Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. It's part three of our seven-part series on creation today, the icons of evolution. When we come back, we'll talk about Ernst Haeckel's embryos.
The sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
How is the Lutheran teaching about the Lord's Supper distinct from other Christian confessions? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is Lutheranism 101, The Lord's Supper. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Lutheranism 101, The Lord's Supper by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Lutheranism 101, The Lord's Supper, The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March.
Real Reformation Radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Higher Things assists in cultivating, encouraging, and promoting a distinctively Lutheran identity among their youth and young adults. To fulfill this mission, this summer, Higher Things has three conferences. You can find out more about these conferences at fromabove2013.org. The winter issue of Higher Things magazine is now available. This is a topical issue on church and state that you can read in its entirety on our website, higherthings.org.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
The Academy of Ancient Music with Surely He Hath Borne Our Griefs from Handel's Messiah, playing right now at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Here is what Paul in Missouri wrote yesterday about LPR. Paul is working on an academic dissertation. He wrote, "Much editing going on this evening. Revisions are always sweet sorrow. One hates to delete so much of what took so long to write. The key is being willing to do so, and the process makes the written work stronger. Thanks to Lutheran Public Radio for serving as the soundtrack for my work this evening and many others. What a great way to work on a project and be edited with good music and to have one's faith strengthened all at once." Paul in Missouri, thank you very much for listening to Lutheran Public Radio. It's there for all of you, by the way, 24/7, 365 days a year. Sacred music for the world at LutheranPublicRadio.org. We follow the course of the church here, and you can listen anytime. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. We're in part three of our seven-part series on creation. Today, the icons of evolution. What are Haeckel's embryos, and what do they purport to show about evolution?
Yes, these are drawings that Ernst Haeckel, a German biologist, put together to try to show that the embryonic development of creatures was very similar, and that all creatures are descended from a fish-like animal. The fancy claim was that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, that our existence inside the womb repeats the evolutionary development of that particular creature. And he put together drawings of the embryo of a fish, a salamander, a tortoise, a chick, a hog, a calf, a rabbit, and a human, and he put them side by side in order to show how similar they were at three different stages in the womb. Well, the problem is there are several problems. First of all, he began with a biased sample, and he selected only those embryos that came closest to fitting his theory. Secondly, he didn't use the same stage. He used the midpoint of the development of the embryo rather than the earliest stages. And then the reality is that he doctored the drawings. I have a picture. I think you can probably find it online if you Google it, but a friend of mine sent me this picture of his drawings compared to actual photographs of these same creatures in the womb, and compared his drawings with the photograph of that embryo at that same stage, and he messed with the drawings so that they're not accurate. Later on, his own university sanctioned him, censured him, I should say, for misleading the public with what he offered, and consequently, his research never should be used.
What are the peppered moths?
That's supposed to be one of the most, that's the most famous example of natural selection, that is evolution by natural selection that's around. Peppered moths are a certain kind of moth that can appear in either a light color or a dark color that Bernard Kettlewell, a British physician and biologist, discovered. And he suggested that in parts of Great Britain where there was a lot of pollution, that when a light-colored moth settled on a darkened tree trunk of a tree, that light-colored moth was a little bit more visible to the birds. The birds ate the light-colored moths, and the dark-colored moths were camouflaged because they were closer to the color of the tree bark. And so he thinks that, that's an illustration of how evolution works by way of natural selection. And you can look this up on the internet too and find all kinds of information about it. You can see pictures of peppered moths on tree trunks. Well, the unfortunate thing for Bernard Kettlewell is that peppered moths in the wild don't rest on tree trunks, and yet you have science textbooks that will show pictures of that happening. And the reality is that the textbook photographs have been staged. Some dead moths have been pinned to the trees or glued to the trees. And in fact, some of the other data contradicts this theory, because there are some heavily polluted areas of Britain, like Manchester, that should, by that theory, only have dark moths, because the light-colored moths would have been eaten by all the birds. But that's not the case. They've got a mix of both of them. Plus, in the rural part of East Anglia, north and northeast of London, where you've got very little industrial pollution, the dark moths are as common as about 80% of the moth population, which is a contradiction to Kettlewell's theory as well.
Tell us about four-winged fruit flies.
Yes, this is one of my favorites. The idea is that fruit flies can develop an extra pair of wings, and it shows that it's done by means of genetic mutations. So it's suggesting if this can happen in a laboratory, that therefore it shows that mutations can truly be a vehicle for evolution. In fact, when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, it was believed by Darwin as well as everybody else that acquired characteristics can be inherited. So if a parent creature became extremely fast, was able to run very, very fast because of training or whatever, then that characteristic would be passed on to its descendants. And so when it became proven that acquired characteristics can't be inherited, evolutionists needed to come up with another vehicle, and mutations are the other major vehicle for explaining how evolution could result in these various creatures. Well, the problem with the four-winged fruit fly, even though it's a beautiful picture and it looks convincing, the problem is that they don't occur spontaneously. They can only be derived in a laboratory by way of mutations. And in fact, the geneticists that produced the four-winged fruit flies had to use three successive mutations, all of them caused by him, in order to achieve that fruit fly. And the end result was fruit flies that have a pair of wings that lack flight muscles. So these fruit flies with the four wings have difficulty flying, difficulty mating, die out easily, and in fact, it's the opposite of the survival of the fittest. That mutation is harmful to the fruit fly and more likely to result in its extinction than in its evolution into some later and more complex version of the fruit fly.
What's the, in the short time that we've got left to us here, what's the Miller-Urey experiment?
Oh, yes, that goes back to the 1950s, where it was thought that a laboratory experiment might possibly be able to simulate the Earth's early atmosphere with electrical sparks and put together an experiment with a heat source and a condenser and some electrodes. And so Harold Urey, who was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist who came up with the idea that the early atmosphere didn't have oxygen in it, since things can oxidize in an atmosphere, oxygen would have been fatal to organic processes, so that the early atmosphere must have been hydrogen, methane, ammonia, and water vapor. So his graduate student, Stanley Miller, tested this with the heat, the condenser, circulating cold water, electrical spark, sealed tubes, and a vacuum line. And after a week, he found two amino acids that are found in proteins, mostly inorganic compounds that do not occur in living organisms. And in fact, science generally believes these days that the early atmosphere of the Earth had free oxygen in it, and so wasn't totally devoid of oxygen as Miller and Urey had concluded.
With the few minutes that are left to us, you're going to be one of the speakers at this conference in July at Concordia University, Wisconsin, The Heavens Declare. Give us a little preview of that conference with no more than a minute here, Dr. Heck.
Yes, we have two world-class astronomers coming in to each to give two plenary addresses about the nature of our universe, the vast distances of outer space, as well as one of our near neighbors, the moon, and what impact the moon has on our understanding of our solar system, as well as our galaxy and our universe. Do the vast distances of outer space that are probably at least 150 billion light years across, does that disprove the biblical account of creation and suggest that our universe is billions of years old rather than thousands of years old, as the Bible seems to suggest? And so we're going to tackle that issue head on with our two keynote speakers, one of whom works for Answers in Genesis and another one that works for the Creation Research Society.
Folks, you can find out more about this conference July the 8th through the 10th at Concordia University, Wisconsin, The Heavens Declare, What Astronomy Can Tell Us About Biblical Creation, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand and plan ahead for July 8th through the 10th at Concordia University, Wisconsin, for The Heavens Declare Conference. Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and author of the book In the Beginning, God. Dr. Heck, I look forward to our next conversation.
And so do I. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to try and fill in a little gap in American Lutheran history. It's not a total gap, but fill in some of our knowledge I certainly needed to learn, on African-American Lutheranism. Pastor Dan Pazika will be our guest. Stay tuned. Did you know that Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, sells CDs and audio downloads of teachings by some of the top Lutheran theologians in the country? Check out Logia's 99-cent download of the month at shop.logia.org, shop.logia.org. You'll also find books published by Luther Academy and, of course, the quarterly Logia Journal at shop.logia.org. Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran, shop.logia.org.
How would you like to attend a conference and hear Rod Rosenblatt, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, Al Schmidt, Suzanne Venker, and Todd Wilkin? You're invited to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation: Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
Issues, etc. What does this mean? We want to hear from you. Why do you listen? How has it helped you? What are your favorite topics? Who are your favorite guests, and what makes Issues Etc. unique? Please leave your thoughts about this worldwide outreach on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Issues Etc. What does this mean? 618-223-8382.